Good morning, everybody. I will call the working group for Real ID to order. So I would like to welcome everybody here this morning. Thank you for being here. The purpose today is we do have a bill that we would like to get the group's approval on and take public testimony on as well to move forward with action on Real ID. So what I'd like to do first is have staff go over the bill before us, and then we will take some member questions and have a discussion after that. Thank you, Mr. Burris.
Madam Chair and members, the bill draft is has an ID in the upper right of 16-6068. It should be in your packet, and I'll just walk through each of the sections briefly. Section 1 contains a directive to the Commissioner of Public Safety to begin with the planning activities, and among those activities it specifically identifies a date of October 1, 2016 to begin issuing Real ID compliant driver's licenses and identification cards. This section also contains a reporting requirement so that the Department of Public Safety would need to come back to the legislature with a report that would be due March 31st of this year, so a little less than a month to assemble some information around planning and finances on the implementation. And then Section 2 contains another directive to the Commissioner of Public Safety, and this regards the current limitations on use of driver's licenses and identification cards issued in Minnesota. So it would be a directive that the commissioner seek an extension similar to what other states have so that Minnesota issued documents could be accepted at federal facilities where there's secured access. That's the current situation is if those facilities were Minnesota issued ID or driver's license alone is not sufficient, and different federal agencies that are implementing this for their secured facilities have, I believe, slightly different procedures depending on the facility for how they handle that with when somebody presents a Minnesota issued document. Section 3 contains a provision around situations when the uses for which a Real ID compliant document is required, and it expresses that the holder of a Minnesota issued Real ID compliant document would not be subject to any future federal uses until there's a review by a legislative group, and the members of that group are spelled out in that section. And then Section 4 contains a rulemaking directive, and it tells the commissioner of the Department of Public Safety to go through the expedited rulemaking process to expressly necessary to produce compliant driver's license and identification cards. And this expedited process authority is set to expire under this section December 31st, 2018. The impact of that can probably be summarized as shortening the overall rulemaking time. A couple of provisions that are sort of absent in the expedited process compared to the usual rulemaking are that there isn't a prior notice that's produced in the state register. There isn't the public hearing, and there's not a statement of need and reasonableness, kind of the document expressing the necessity for the rule. Other than that, the general procedures are pretty similar as far as the rulemaking still being in the form that's established, that's drafted or created or confirmed by the revisor of statutes. It still goes through the administrative law judge opinion process and confirmation. It's still subject to potentially to going into court if there are challenges to it. And there are a couple of timeline pieces in the expedited process, but on net, it's probably shorter by, you know, somewhere in the order of a few months. And then finally, Section 5 of the bill draft has the repealer of the current ban. And all of these provisions would go into effect the day following enactment of the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Burris. And just a couple of things before we get going on a discussion. I just want to welcome online, on the phone, we have Representative Dennis Smith, Representative Tim Miller, Representative Cindy Pugh. And feel free online there to, or on the phone, good morning, to pop in with questions if you have them. Also of note is that this bill is the first of two bills that will address Real ID. This is just the preliminary bill. We're hoping that during the first few days of session to suspend the rules and take up this bill so that we can get the department, we enable them to start working on what it would take to comply with Real ID. A second bill will go into more detail about what that's going to look like. And if you look at Section 1 of this bill, once the department gets a report, they do report back to ranking members of several committees here in the legislature. So we will have that report in hand, and I'm sure that will probably be heard in several committees, or maybe we'll have one joint committee, I don't know. But so the legislature will be able to weigh in on what the findings are of the department. With that, Senator Dibble, do you have any other comments before we get started on discussion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to express my appreciation for your work on this and your consideration of some additional elements that I was able to add or request that you add to this draft, which included the October 1st expectation being articulated. We can talk about the reason for that during our discussion, and then, of course, getting going on the extension so folks with their existing driver's licenses can start accessing federal facilities. And I can't remember if you had already included the official purpose thing. If the Department of Homeland Security, if they dream up some other purpose.
Right.
So maybe not everything we would want, and it would be ideal if federal law were changed on that matter, but mm-hmm. if we say something about it here.
Right.
Thanks. And then we can talk about, I think I sent you an email and I have a copy of it just to remind myself if folks want to also during discussion go over what we might need to cover in bill number two.
Okay. Very good. Representative Faber.
thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. I have a cold, so I'm hopefully am capable of being understood.
We can hear you just fine.
Thank you. I just have a couple technical questions which might be appropriate for nonpartisan staff.
Just a second. Can we interrupt you?
Sorry. I just wanted to mention to members, in case if they hadn't yet noticed, there's some one-sheeters on rulemaking, kind of the ins and the outs of rulemaking. If it were to go through a regular process or legislative authorization for expedited rulemaking, and then there's one more about review of adopted rules.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on Section 3, just a couple of questions about our ability to do this. It says that no holder of a Minnesota driver's license is bound by the requirements of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security unless it's in the Real ID Act. Part B says that any change the Department of Homeland Security makes must be reviewed by a committee of various legislative members. I guess I'm just wondering, is that something we even have the authority to do? I mean, part of the reason we're in this situation is because, you know, we tried to not abide by the federal requirements. I mean, obviously, there's something to be said for that at certain times, but, you know, when the federal government can have that sort of stick of federal preemption and saying that no, you know, Minnesotan can get onto a plane, I guess I just want to make sure that these sorts of requirements aren't going to create a problem further down the road.
Mr. Burris?
Madam Chair, Representative Freiberg, I think you raise a valid point. There's a preemption issue regarding whether and to what extent the state can direct or limit the official purposes, because that is the federal law. And the rules that were promulgated under the Real ID Act included a potential expansion of those purposes. So from one standpoint, this section can arguably be viewed as an expression of concern about future expansion. And it is under the purview of state law to direct legislative, you know, for the legislature to essentially direct itself to review activities that occur in the future. But the actual enforcement of this, there are some questions about that, and it's really going to be federal agencies determining whether they're going to accept Minnesota-issued documents based on federal law, regardless of what state law establishes. To your question on what impact this might have from a compliance standpoint, I defer to the department, both the Department of Public Safety and Homeland Security, as to what their reactions to this might be.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Freiberg, I think you're exactly right. This is weak tea. And we don't know. So just to be clear, you know, this tries to address those circumstances, like I just talked about a minute ago, in which the Secretary of Homeland Security dreams up a whole new reason for the Real ID that was not specifically spelled out in the law when it was passed. And so it provides for a mechanism, at least a mechanism that we take a look at that as a state before we say okie dokie. But can we do that or not? You know, yeah, it would maybe put us back in the same soup we're in with respect to that purpose. The only real remedy is some sort of change to federal law. I don't know if Ms. Berzosky has any more insight or not. She helped us come up with this language. It's her fault. No, I'm just kidding.
Mr. Chair, no, I think you expressed it exactly correctly, and I think that paragraph B, what it suggests to me when I read it is that the legislature takes a look at the changes, and the Real ID Act does empower the Department of Homeland Security to define federal purpose. So the way it's defined in the Act today may not be the way it's defined at some future date. So paragraph B would say that the legislature has to take a look at this, and I suppose there are potential remedies through courts, for example, that somebody may choose to pursue if there's an overreaching determination concerning the meaning of federal purpose. But as far as being bound by the requirements of Department of Homeland Security, that's a fairly big bite. Department of Homeland Security is, if it expands federal purpose, for example, to say that people can't go into a federal courthouse unless they have a Real ID compliant ID, then this language doesn't mean a whole lot, because if there are guards at the door saying you can't come in, there's the Minnesotan can't really probably accomplish much by saying, well, you know, our law says I'm not bound by your regulations. But I think it is a lead in to paragraph B as far as at least requiring, a good look at the new scope that may emerge of this law, and then potentially deciding if there are remedies available to the state.
Thank you. That's helpful information. My follow-up would be on Section 4, Part B, just the bit about expedited rulemaking. In my first term, I was on the Government Operations Committee here, and so I did learn a bit about how the rulemaking process works and the expedited rulemaking process. I know there had been some concerns raised that, using an expedited rulemaking process takes out some of the notice requirements, and various legislators expressed concern that put a fair amount of power in state officials, unelected officials. That's fine, I guess. I'm considering some of the concerns that brought this here in the first place. you know, I guess I was kind of surprised to see that. I am wondering about line 3.5. The authority under this section expires in 2018. Just this might be for Mr. Burris or Ms. Berezovsky. I don't know. I'm just wondering, does that mean that the ability to use expedited rulemaking expires, and meaning that there would then be a full rulemaking process, or does it take away all rulemaking authority, whether expedited or full?
Mr. Burris?
Madam Chair, Representative Freiberg, I would read this as just halting any further expedited process. The department has rulemaking authority related to driver's licensing and a bunch of other areas under its purview under statutory law. So this is a provision that's over and above that and allows, you know, kind of faster, fewer steps process for a limited time. So I would read this as just halting them, the ability of the department to use expedited process or additional rulemaking under this provision. And that I wouldn't read it as eliminating the rules at that point. So the rules would stay in effect.
Thank you. And again, one of the reasons for putting that in is if we want to start issuing these things in October so that we have the full 4 years for people when they renew their licenses, that's kind of the onus of putting that provision in there with the expedited rulemaking. It's not the most comfortable thing in the world to me either, but we're kind of under a timeline here. So I'll go to my list now. Representative Limmer?
Ms. Berezovsky.
Oh, Ms. Berezovsky has it. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to respond further to Representative Freiberg's comment about the expedited process and just call your attention to the fact that there is an option in the expedited process to call for a public hearing if there are 100 people who would like to have a public hearing. But the way this is drafted, there would not be a public hearing. So there has to be specific reference to Subdivision 5 in order to bring in that possibility of a public hearing.
Thank you for that. It's helpful information. I'm going to go to my list now. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I came in a little late, 10 minutes late. Sorry about that. Just wanted to know, have we had a detailed explanation and review of the bill before us?
Yes, we did, Senator. We had Mr. Burris walk through the bill.
Okay.
But if you have questions.
I do. I had the good fortune to read it over this morning. And some of the questions I do have, first is on the repealer. The way the bill has been described is that it's a phase one bill, meaning that we will lift the moratorium on the discussion and analysis for our departments and agencies to review what the federal government's mandate is on the state of Minnesota. As I look at the actual statute that you're repealing, that statute says the commissioner of public this is existing law, the commissioner of public safety is prohibited from taking any action to implement or plan or the implementation of this state known of those sections of public law known as Real ID Act in the federal government. The way I'm reading it is that we are repealing all of those provisions in the 2009 legislation that prohibited Real ID from being enacted in this state. I don't read that as a phase one. I read it as a total repeal of the entire provision, and it could allow the departments to go ahead, perhaps even with rulemaking authority, to implement Real ID without any further legislative action. Am I correct in that analysis?
Well, I will let Mr. Burris address this in a second, but we do have language in that first on the first page there in the first section that says after the department gets a report together, they come back and report to the legislature. So we will have input at that time, but Mr. Burris, if you want to address the questions in more detail, that'd be great.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I would share your view that the repealer eliminates all of the current law prohibitions around both planning and implementation. So just taken as a repeal, just looking at that section, the department has kind of taken then to what its body of statutory authority is now to administer driver's licensing, which I think can reasonably be viewed as pretty broad. The department has a set of rules that are authorized under current statutes, and there are, you know, a number of provisions around general and fairly specific requirements on issuance of driver's licenses. So that body of current law, absent the repealer, can it kind of makes, I think, a strong argument for the department's authority to meet requirements under the Real ID Act. Then there's the other provisions, and Representative Scott noted one that I was going to highlight, which is in Section 1, Paragraph A, which is an affirmative directive to the Department of Public Safety to begin planning activities. And it notes planning activities, but it also sets a date for anticipating to begin issuance of compliant driver's licenses and identification cards. And then the other thing that had been discussed is Section 4, which is the rulemaking authority. Between those two provisions, I think it would be likely that the department would view the totality of this, were it enacted, as giving them sufficient authority to begin planning and implementation as necessary to move towards Real ID compliant issuances. Obviously, the legislature could enact further legislation in this session or a future session modifying that further.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Levin.
For some reason, I was under the impression that this particular bill that we're considering today was a phase one implementation of first and foremost allowing the departments that are involved in Real ID to analyze what the federal government is demanding of the states and to determine costs and other issues in its implementation, but that it would not lift the prohibition until we actually had a bill that would put that into a more formal aptitude. And now I'm getting the impression that this is all that's needed to pass it. Sure, we're going to get a report sometime at the end of the month, but it looks like we're allowing the departments to begin, as you can see on line 1.9, including activities necessary to begin issuing Real ID compliant driver licenses. So I don't think this is a phase one at all. This is a phase one and two and whatever else that we might have been thinking that we were going to do in a stepped fashion. Keep in mind that the federal government has extended the deadline for all states until 2018, and even further, there's a reference to 2020. And so I have to ask the question, why are we in such a rush to get things done a mere month after, well, less than 1 month after we begin this legislative session? Now, granted, I know we have a short time period, but even the issuance of a report, we get the report on March 31st, and our first deadline is April 1st. This legislature will have one day to analyze the report, one day to pass it, and once again, the public does not get any opportunity to really have time to understand what the federal government and now that what the state government is wanting to do regarding an ID card that is expandable anytime in the future by a political appointee in Washington. That's been the problem with the Real ID card ever since 2005. We remember that this was passed in the dead of night at 2:30 in the morning without a roll call vote as an amendment to a military appropriation bill for the war in Afghanistan, a bill that absolutely would be passed. And then that particular amendment was passed the way it was with no public participation and no committee scrutiny. Now, thank goodness we've had the scrutiny on this year, and I'm glad the legislature had the foresight to do that. But I don't know, quite honestly, how much the public is really following this. Maybe they don't care, but I think they may care sometime in the future when ID cards are used for something far more than just driver licenses. And so I guess the question is why are we in a hurry to rush this along when the federal government has suddenly dropped the pressure on all the states until 2018? Is there a reason why we have this particular timeline?
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You raise some good points, Senator Limmer, and maybe some of the language needs to be a little more precise because I think it was Representative Scott's goal, as was articulated and is articulated in the first part of the bill, to do a phase two. I think there's an attempt to strike a balance in a compressed legislative session to both give voice to the concerns that were broadly shared when we passed the prohibition, but also get us on the path yet this legislative session towards issuing real ID compliant driver's license. The March 31st date would necessitate, and I don't know that we've had any conversation with, I haven't had any conversation with leadership, would necessitate, if we want there to be a bill too that has the proper amount of consideration, both in terms of its instruction as well as its hearing, would necessitate waiving the deadline rules. So I don't know if that's in the cards or not, so we need to figure that out. And then obviously we would need to deal with some fairly significant issues in bill number two that aren't addressed in bill number one. I have my little list here. You know, how are we going to pay for it? Both the startup and the ongoing costs. We'd make an attempt to deal with the later dreamt up official purpose of the Secretary of Homeland Security in this bill, but we might need a more precise way of dealing with that. So, you know, how we're going to deal with, as a matter of state policy, the issues around privacy sharing, privacy restrictions, access, et cetera. We probably need some language to button that up because, of course, at least the Real ID driver's license database will be easily accessed by other states and the federal government. We do have some language that we would need to remove from law that would prohibit our clear path towards implementation. That specifically is the driver's license that we can issue to seniors that doesn't expire. That needs to be modified or eliminated. Whether or not we're going to authorize a second-tier driver's license, a non-compliant driver's license for those who don't choose to opt for a real ID-compliant license for their own reasons. And then there's the whole subject around deputy registrars, of course. That's a complicated issue. Are they situated and suited to receive the kind of documentation necessary in the kind of confidential, protected fashion that being Real ID compliant requires, and do they have all the capital equipment necessary to do that, and that sort of thing? That's kind of a complicated question that we need to answer too. So a bill two is necessary, clearly, because we don't deal with any of those issues in this bill. But to Mr. Burris's point, if we pass this bill and it's clear sailing, maybe we need to be a little more precise with our language.
One other question, Madam Chair. This is for counsel. Counsel, the way you have analyzed this bill, let's see, who am I talking to here? Okay. I'll ask Mr. Borowski. The question I have is, if this particular bill is passed, can the Department of Public Safety start issuing Real ID compliant driver licenses without any further action by the legislature?
Mrs. Berezovsky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Limmer, in my opinion, as I read and understand this bill, there are only a couple of hurdles or barriers to implementation based upon the language of this bill. One of those is that this bill does not include a couple of relatively minor statutory changes that the Department of Homeland Security already identified as being necessary for the state to be in full compliance with Real ID. And those changes do not appear in this bill draft. And the other one is that there's no provision for payment of cost. And so maybe I would defer to Ms. Boyd on this as to what would happen if there is no appropriation or provision made for the payment of the startup costs. But other than that, the repeal of the prohibition, the specific direction to the department to adopt rules to move to full compliance by October 1st, the existing statutory rulemaking authority that the department has that the prohibition has sort of, you know, put a stop to exercising right at this time. All of those together, in my mind, aside from those two barriers that I mentioned, would authorize the department to go ahead and implement.
Thank you. Ms. Boyd, did you have any comment on that?
Madam Chair, I would only state as obvious that the department only has the existing appropriation available to it. If there are no further costs included in this bill and they are charged with beginning to implement, it would have to be with existing resources until a further bill is passed. There is a fund balance in the driver services operating account, but that would not be available to them until an appropriation is made, so they would have to be using existing resources. If there are talks of using other sources or raising fees, those would have to be addressed in a second bill.
Thank you. Senator Nelson had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple things that have come to mind during this discussion. One, I want to be clear that my district feels the urgency of being able to enter federal buildings and military bases. And there has been great concern in my district regarding the lack of a federal compliant ID. And I think what was even more concerning was the lack of information. People can plan if they have information, but the lack of information about what would be acceptable for various uses by our state citizens did cause great angst. So I do feel the urgency to repeal the ban on the plan. And that's what I thought we discussed in some of our earlier meetings, that there was universal agreement that we needed to repeal the ban on planning. And so I appreciate the urgency in that regard. And then to ask for an extension. So repeal the ban on the plan, on the planning activity, and then ask for an extension. And that is what I see as the best way forward at this point. There's been a lot of other discussions here that have raised a lot of questions regarding implementation. And by repealing, in fact, you'll remember at one of our earlier meetings, I submitted a draft proposal, which was basically just Section 5 of this bill, which was repealing Laws 2009, Chapter 92, Section 1. And you'll recall the discussion we had at that time was that by just putting in that repealer language, that the department would have the implicit authorization to implement. And there was significant discussion about that. I'm sure it is on the tapes. And with that discussion, I think it was Senator Dibble had the clearest read on that, which was that by the repeal alone, department already had the authority to implement. And so, and with that discussion in mind, I withdrew the bill because of that very reason. And so, but yet then we see it right here again today. And so my question would be, I again sense the urgency to repeal the ban on the planning and then ask for an extension. But I am a little cautious about allowing the full repeal, which would give the department the authority to implement without further legislative action. And I think that is something that we should contemplate seriously. And then the other question I had was along the lines of Section 3. And that was what I guess we would typically call comfort language, which is trying to address maybe that expanding scope that the Department of Homeland Security might have in what uses it expands the need for compliant ID for. And so I appreciate the comfort language and realize its need, but here's my question on that. I think Mr. Burr said we're not sure how this Section 3 would impact compliance. We might not want to not be granted an extension because of this compliant, this language that might be detrimental to that extension. And so my question has to do with the process. So if in fact we pass this legislation with this comfort language or this expression of concern, I like the way you said that, the expression of concern about the federal expansion, and we had applied for the extension and let's just say it was denied based on this language, what's the time frame in which Minnesota could come back then with a clean proposal that did not include this comfort language? What's the timeline on that?
I guess I would ask House staff on that or Senate staff on that. My understanding is that you have till 2018 to get the extension, but I guess I would defer to Mr. Burris.
Representative Scott, Senator Nelson, it sounds like you're asking about what would be the timeline to
reapply for an extension with clean language,
and
yes.
I believe last time I checked, there wasn't a wait period before attempting a subsequent request for extension.
Would be your understanding be that we would have till 2018 to get the extension?
Representative Scott, the 2018 deadline is that regards the point at which Real ID compliance or states under an extension cards are required in order to board federally regulated aircraft. So it's kind of a difference between the federal aircraft component and accessing secured federal facilities, which is in place already as sort of the first of the DHS enforcement measures.
Okay. And so, go ahead, Senator Gill.
Thanks. I just there's several different issues, like three different issues that we need to parse on this extension compliance subject. One is we probably need an extension as soon as possible.
Yes.
Because remember, three elements of Real ID are already in full force and effect, and so there are people being barred from entering military bases and certain types of federal facilities and nuclear facilities today with their existing Minnesota driver's license. So, so we need the department to be able to begin working with the Department of Homeland Security to receive an immediate extension for those purposes. Then there's the question of an extension being granted to Minnesotans for the purposes of boarding aircraft without Real ID compliant driver's licenses before kind of the ultimate drop dead hammer of 2020. And so we may or may not need that. We would need that if we decide that we want people, which is kind of the third issue, leads into the third issue, if we want people to be able to renew their driver's license on the regular four-year rotating schedule that we have today. That would, of course, need to start happening on October 1st of this year, because the way the advisory read from Department of Homeland Security, this boarding aircraft element is in effect 2018, but everyone absolutely has to have a driver's license in their pocket that's compliant by October 1st of 2020. So We would for sure, if we want folks to be able to kind of just renew on their regular routine schedule rather than having to renew sooner than the 4 years, which would either necessitate them paying an additional fee or are picking up that cost. And also, we would need to know that the offices that are going to receive a spike in business, whether those are the registrars or the regular licensing offices operated by the state, you know, we're going to be fitting a lot of folks through a fairly narrow pipe in a short period of time if we speed up the schedule of distributing and dispersing Real ID compliant licenses. We would need an extension for those purposes, but also the capacity to do that. Does that make sense? Or is that too complicated? So it's kind of three elements to this extension question.
Senator Nelson, any follow-up on that?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So yes, there is an urgency. There's an urgency for an extension. And that urgency for an extension, I would, at a very minimum, we must repeal the ban on planning. And the questions that we have before us today, I think, are legitimate questions. But I think the essential thing that is on March 8th, we submit a bill that repeals the ban on the plan and then proceed forward, the ban on planning, and then proceed forward with these other issues if we have not resolved them sooner. I think we must be committed that on March 8th, I hope as the task force, we would need to submit a bill that would repeal the ban on the planning and then ask for reapplication for that extension. That should be our minimum that we expect moving forward here.
Thank you. Ms. Berezovsky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to add to that in response to the Senator's question that under the CFR regulations to the Real ID Act, at this point, extensions are within the discretion of the Secretary of Homeland Security. So you had asked about re-asking, reapplying. So there are no standards on that in the law or the regs, but just simply up to the discretion of the Secretary.
Thank you very much.
Senator DeVos.
But we do have some indication, and I'll ask Ms. Tincher maybe if she has a little more insight, some indication that if we start taking some tangible affirmative steps towards compliance, some indication, pretty strong indication, that the Secretary would look favorably upon that and would strongly consider granting at least this first extension that we need, which is for folks to get into CDC facilities, military bases, nuclear facilities, and the like.
Hello. Yes, I'm hopeful and actually optimistic that we would be able to get an extension and remove that barrier from folks that are using a regular Minnesota driver's license right now if the Department of Homeland Security felt we were on a path toward a plan for implementation. The timeline for that actual plan for implementation to be approved by the Department of Homeland Security would potentially take, that would be up to their discretion. So that's part of the challenge that in terms of a timeline, that's what we're worried about is, you know, we would get caught up in, even if we get all of our work done, then we are caught up in their timeline for approval. So that would impact. One other thing, just while I have a moment, I just wanted to clarify that, and nonpartisan staff could maybe weigh in on this, but I just wanted to clarify that the Department of Public Safety currently does not have authority to promulgate rules. In 1997, their authority to do that was repealed. So whether it was expedited or otherwise, they would need explicit authorization to promulgate rules on this. That's our interpretation of rulemaking for the department.
Well, thank you for that information. Quick follow-up, Representative or Senator Nelson.
Yep, just two quick questions. One, the governor had requested an extension in December, and just as a marker, how long did it take before we received the rejection of that extension? So that might give us some idea as far as Department of Homeland Security. And then my second question, I'll save that till I get this first answer,
Ms.
I guess.
Do you happen to know the answer to that question?
I don't, but I'll ask my folks. I might be able to get the answer pretty quickly.
Okay. Staff is thinking it was around 2 months.
I think it was, yeah, 2 months. All right. And I'll save my other question. That's fine.
Okay, very good. I'll go on down my list here. Representative Mariani.
Thank you very much. And I, too, like Senator Limmer, was late, and so I apologize for that. But I do want to acknowledge the good faith effort on both of our chairs here to keep us focused on this work of this issue. And I want to thank Chair Scott for bringing in a working bill, a draft. It's a lot easier having something to work off of as opposed to just kind of going around and around on some issues. I do have to say, though, that there is something missing in the language before us, and that's where some of the tension, you know, that's before us right now, that began with Representative Freiberg's question and then with Senator Limmer's question. So, you know, these are not partisan concerns. They do reflect the unanimous vote that we had half a dozen years ago, or maybe longer, on this issue in both bodies. And that really has to do with the whole data privacy issue. I mean, that's kind of the big elephant, you know, that was in the room then, that's in the room now. And quite frankly, I believe, folks, that I think our state ought to take a muscular stance on that issue. The fact that the federal government, in my opinion, said, oh, yeah, you know, we scared the heck out of everyone in Minnesota, but, you know, now we're going to give you 2 years. To me, is a clear signal that there is a desire, and I'm not being disparaging here, but that there is a desire to work this thing out in a way that's consistent with the things that we value as well as the things that the federal government values. And I suspect, I'm wrong, I may be wrong, and others can jump in and say you're wrong on this, Carlos, but I don't think anyone in the table here would be objecting to a strong data privacy stance on the part of this legislature relative to this legislation. And it seems to me that there's kind of two ways in which we can do that. One is to just, you know, kind of do the, you know, perhaps kind of cowboy stance of, you know, let's put language in that Section 3 that just says, you know, once we review it, you know, at any future date, and the federal government changes things, because they do have the ability to change the scope of real ID, they do, of real ID. And I think Senator Limmer is absolutely correct. That could be done bureaucratically. That doesn't necessarily need to be done through congressional legislative action. That's why they wrote it the way that they did. So that authority already exists in the presidential executive branch. And so if we reach that point, I guess one posture for us, you know, is just to say, look, at any future date in which this violates Minnesota's, you know, values in regards to data privacy and the integrity of the state having the authority to shape a license that meets our needs in terms of public safety in our state, then all bets are off. Now, you know, that's, you know, obviously a bit of brinkmanship, and, you know, brinkmanship is typically not very good. It may make for good electioneering, but not necessarily for good governance. I think a better tact for us is to create what I would call a safety valve, a fallback position that just exists now and will always exist. And that really is to have, and frankly other states have done this, both Democratic and Republican states have done this, and that's to create an alternative license that's not compliant with real ID but is a legitimate instrument that guarantees the public safety, it meets our obligations as a state. And I think we can do that whether all we do is, to Senator Nelson's point, all we do is move forward with a, you know, planning, you know, as first step. I think we can still also simultaneously do that issue because that's our issue. You know, maybe it's not the federal government's issue, but that's our issue, and we can move forward with that. We can also do it moving under your framework, Madam Chair, of taking, you know, more assertive steps along the lines toward real ID. Neither one of those approaches, in my mind, preempts us from fulfilling our obligation consistent with the actions that we took unanimously, consistent with our concerns for public safety in the state. And so I guess the big broad question, and this is for all of us, you know, is, so where is the data privacy language? Where is the state authority, maintaining a state authority and integrity language presently that we should be moving forward. It's not here, even though it's here in the conversation. It's here in the conversation in a bipartisan way. We're not talking about anything controversial. I think we can move forward with that kind of an element. I would offer that. I do have a bill draft that does that. I'm not saying it's perfect, but I'd be willing to share that, you know, with the group and with the chairs if you think that's appropriate, Madam Chair. I always get to the point where I berate the point over and over again. Let me just say, you know, we're in many ways being forced by the federal government to do something we're not totally comfortable with, even though we understand the logic and we want to be in solidarity with the legitimate concerns of the federal government. We're not without muscle in that determination. And all I'm saying is I think we ought to exercise, you know, the responsibility that we have as state legislators to ensure that we've got that strong data privacy protection piece in the existence of a non-compliant, real ID non-compliant alternative license. Other states have done this. Many other states have done. In fact, other states have done this in the process of negotiating with the federal government. So I don't think we need to fear that the feds are going to say, no, Minnesota, you can't do that. Although, quite frankly, as a state legislator, I'd still tell them, well, we're going to do it anyway. So, Madam Chair, I just want to circle this back to where this conversation began with the opening questions here, because I think these are core to coming at a bipartisan solution to responding to this urgent need.
Well, thank you, Representative Mariani. We're going to skip to Representative Hansen. We'll come back to Representative Quam. Evidently, Representative Hansen has to leave shortly, so go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have to go chair the Audit Commission downstairs at 11, so I'll go quick. I'd like, if it hasn't been done already, to formally ask for a fiscal note on the bill that's in front of us. I think that's important to look at what the cost is. I come from a little different perspective than Representative Mariani and Senator Nelson. I think that what I'm hearing from my district is get this done. Don't take a half step. Just get this done. And I think that could be done by the bill that I had drafted that provides for an opt-out for folks that we could do this. I think if we just repeal the ability to talk, we are failing. I think that our constituents, I'm hearing from businesses that they are affected right now. Businesses going to D.C. and can't get in federal buildings, and they're being told to get a passport or an enhanced driver's license. So there's an impact right now. I've been contacted by constituents who can't visit their kid at a military base. So if we punt, I think we will have failed. I think that our constituents expect us to do the work. I'm reminded of Aesop's fable of the mountain trembled and labored mightily and then produced a mouse. And I think that's where we are with this. I would hope that we could do something more substantive. I would hope that we would be clear, and we can have hearings if we give the authority to DPS, have hearings once a week on how they're doing and see what they're doing and bring them into the dock and ask questions about what they're doing. We have that authority whether we're in session or not. And then have the public there and have them accountable. There's things we can do rather than let's trying to work this out and it doesn't, and then we come back with just doing a pass. So I understand the desire to do something early. I think we need to, because I think folks are expecting that. But I would encourage us to do more. And I think the Senator Dibble brought a point about the deputy registers of how do we make sure we can be having the access around the state for folks and have the security around the state so we don't have this is the data, but that we provide service equitably for people to be able to comply. So whenever we do this, whenever we actually make the decision, we don't have a massive rush into the system, whether that's in 16, 17, 18, 19, or 20, we should have the ability to plan, and I would ask us to do that better. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do very much appreciate the thoroughness and completeness that my honorable and esteemed colleagues have enumerated and lightened the areas of concern and question. I am somewhat relieved of trepidation because of the historic tendency and trend of the department to not assume and absorb financial aspects of bills, and this would be, I would consider, non-trivial. So I'm less concerned about the staging and the threat of over-exuberance from the department, because that would be, you know, again, a non-trivial expenditure that would be absorbed, and I don't see that as being historically trending. I do think that there is problematic issues with getting a fiscal note of any thoroughness and completeness without having first passed the repeal of, you know, the blocking of any activity. So I think it's very much appropriate that this group and body go forward with the primary stage to enable the capability and possibility. My constituents are very much concerned, and some of it's hyperbole, because I know of no base commander that would not avail themselves of the powers of which they have of having guest lists and allowing escorts for people to visit if there's a graduation ceremony or a soldier that's in a hospital and would deny the families. I think businesses have mainly been proactive, especially considering that the administration received about a year ago notification from Homeland Security in a letter, which then was shortly after made public, that indicated the upcoming deadline. So the media likes to, you know, blow things up. This is a very important, non-trivial issue that needs to be addressed, and I hope that we can go through the appropriate stages to get this done because of our truncated session. So again, I very much appreciate the information, discussion on these, you know, critical points, but that doesn't prevent me from feeling that we can go forward without undue risk. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're in kind of a funny situation here because we can't, you know, vote on anything in this, you know, to send it forward because we're not in session. And because of the kind of macro urgency of this, we need to have a relatively clean bill so that it can move forward without delay. But I'm very concerned that because of our deadlines, we're asking the commissioner to bring a report back March 31st. We will already be at policy deadlines at that point. And so we'll be really kind of under duress at that point. You know, it'd be very difficult to provide direction going forward after that point. And so, and there are quite a number of issues that I think we ought to be providing some direction on in terms of what, you know, what we would like this system to do for the people in Minnesota. So we've kicked around some of the ideas about are we going to have more than one tier of license. Currently we've got the two. You know, we have the non-compliant license or ID and the enhanced license that can be used for border crossings. Are we going to keep the enhanced license as an option? Is that, you know, something we want to happen? Are we going to have a non-compliant license as an option? So is this going to be one tier, two tiers, or three tiers? And the bill doesn't raise that question, and I don't think we could settle that question before we would want this bill to go forward, but I think that we should be crafting other bills that can be taken up in committee as soon as possible. And I'm not on those committees, so I don't know what the intent is there, but I really hope that that's going to happen. The other thing is we don't know how much time it's going to take to get an extension, if we get the extension. But the one thing we know is it will actually take some time. And the current situation is that anybody who gets a job or a new job responsibility that would require them to have the enhanced ID or a passport in order to do border crossings or to go into federal facilities or whatnot, currently you are forced to pay not only the $15 for the enhanced ID, but also to pay approximately the same amount, so it ends up being $30 if your license is out of sync. You know, if you've got time left on your license, you have to pay to replace it. Could we bring a bill that would allow a temporary waiver of that in fairness for people that are caught up in this thing that's, you know, through absolutely no fault of their own, that this system is messed up for those people? Sure, that would, you know, there'd be a fiscal note to that, but it can't be very large because there's not that many people that want to go through the process of getting, no, nobody's going to go through that enhanced ID just for fun because it's a lot of paperwork. So I'd be really interested in seeing some of those things being taken up early in the committees and not waiting around to see what the commissioner comes back with and then trying to squeeze it into what time we've got left.
Thank you, Representative. I think, you know, there's nothing stopping any member from putting a bill forward, absolutely, and trying to get it started through the committee process and at least have this vetted amongst more people than just the people sitting around this table, although there are quite a few of us. So next on my list, Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to address kind of two different things I'm hearing. One is we do have obviously the privacy concerns, but then there's the timeline and the fear that we need to do this within this session. And for me, when I think about this, we were just discussing this earlier, we do have the enhanced ID, and my understanding is that when folks that are very concerned about it, my constituents, for example, if I explain that that is an option, it does alleviate a lot of concern. And there has been a huge spike in the amount of people that are applying for and getting enhanced IDs. So if I'm, you know, looking forward, I would rather err on the side of caution, protecting the privacy of Minnesotans, and taking our time to fully vet this, as well as educate the populace, than moving forward out of this fear of we have to do it within this session and comply with the federal government, because, as was previously mentioned by Senator Limmer and others, we do have at least until 2018, if not 2020. In addition, the biggest concern for me is that if we don't fully vet this, an unelected Washington appointee could decide to expand the scope of this at any time, and that's an unintended legislative consequence that we can't foresee right now, that I just want to make sure Minnesotans are aware of and that we consider and address. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another question for Council, if I could direct your attention to line 2.11. This is the portion of this proposal that talks about directing the Commissioner of Public Safety to seek an extension. We've been talking about a lot of extensions today, and we do know that the base extension that has been given to all states has been changed. You know, when we first started this discussion at the very beginning of the year, or even before the beginning of this year, we had a rather immediate time frame to deal with, a matter of months. And on January 7th, the Homeland Security extended a universal extension to January of 2018. And now this particular extension that we're talking about on line 211 does this mean that this would be an extension beyond the January 2018? And if not, then why do we need this in this bill at all?
Oh, I'm sorry. Are you addressing that to the Senate Council?
Council, yes.
Okay.
Chair and Senator Limmer, the action that was taken that you were talking about in terms of an extension really just changes the effective date of a part of the Real ID Act, which has to do with boarding commercial airplanes. That
the implementation date was moved out to 18 or 20. There are already phases of Real ID that are now in effect, such as accessing high security federal facilities. Mm-hmm. And the extension that would be sought in that part of the bill has to do with allowing Minnesota holders of current Minnesota driver's licenses to access those facilities, or to use that as their ID that would, you know, allow them entry to those facilities. So they wouldn't need the compliant ID yet, even though that piece of Real ID is implemented, and that extension that you spoke of does not affect that. That is an effect.
Right. And Madam Chair,
Senator Limmer,
do we have anyone from the U.S. military or the State National Guard that could answer a few questions about this particular aspect of the bill?
Is there anyone in the audience that is of that background? It's too bad our citizen is not here that was on the committee. Ms. Hsu is a member of the National Guard here in Minnesota, but she's opposite.
Well, Madam Chair, is there anyone from Homeland Security in the room that could answer questions?
Is there anyone from Homeland Security in the room? No.
And Madam Chair, Madam Chair, if I can just put some light on this particular relationship. We have a situation where the federal government is mandating states to do something, or else. They've had quiet, private, I could even call it secret meetings with some of us last September at the VA building, and they restricted the public from being involved in it. And only after the insistence of a few members in that group did we allow the press that was mounting outside the door to be allowed in. That's the type of relationship we are tying ourselves into regarding this policy. When asked if they would be at a hearing like this, they simply said, and this was the assistant Secretary of Homeland Security, he said, no, we won't be there. We do not make it our policy to be a part of any addressing any other political division of state or federal government. We don't get involved in that. And in past years, when I was chairman of the Judiciary Committee, they would come to me privately wanting up to $6 million of funds to at least fit into some other program. And I would simply invite them to come to the committee and address the committee and let us ask them questions. Once I invited them to be a part of a committee hearing, they said, no, we will not participate. They want $6 million of our taxpayers' money, but they refuse to be a part of the public record. That's the type of relationship that we're getting into with this particular bill. We are acquiescing to a federal demand, and I would underline the word demand. We won't have control of the expansion of this particular policy in the future, because Congress has already given the authority to Homeland Security Director to expand it whenever they have a whim that they deem appropriate. This is something that should not be done quickly, and we have the time. That's the important thing. We have the time till 2018. And this proposal is, and Senator Nelson is correct, we should open the gate for our administration to discuss research and give us direction on the aspects of this particular policy. I'm much more cautious about taking all of our prohibition off and giving the authority to that same department to implement. And that's what this bill does. So this is a kind of a corporate decision that we make, but that we've heard the words of caution from a few of our members, but we have the time to do it right. Minnesota is one of those few states that honor and respect the sense of privacy for its citizens in a time when government wants more, corporations want more information. We have held firm, and this is going to be a major test of whether or not we just bow to the demands and the threats of the federal government, that if you don't do it our way, we'll do things like restrict access. They won't come to our committees to explain their policies, but they want us to acquiesce to the demands. Think about our responsibility. That first section of our Constitution says we should protect our citizens. And I think this bill could be modified, that it would be accepted. We can take that major step in allowing our experts in state government, our administrations, to analyze and give proposals back while we still have plenty of time to do that. And we can review that information more than one day to make that decision. And then we can perhaps examine some of the suggestions that Representative Mariani had suggested. What do you do if the federal government wants more that we're not comfortable with? Should there be a provision in our state laws that do that? I think so. And if other states have done it, and they don't seem to be, the federal government doesn't seem to be getting all twisted out of shape when they do it, why aren't we doing it? So that's my two cents, but I'm very impassioned about this issue. Privacy is one of the last little fences around all our personal lives that we can still call our own, and it's getting intruded upon every day, not only by government, but by private corporations.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. Before we move on, I'm going to have Ms. Tincher weigh in. I think she has to part from our group here. So I just wanted to see what your thoughts were on the bill and if you believe that this language would meet with the governor's approval. If not, what changes would...
Sure. Well, so I just wanted to respond really quickly. I did not anticipate that there would be any questions of the National Guard, and I can assure you that General Nash would be happy to answer any questions now. If you want to send those to me, we can get those answers. He otherwise would have made sure that someone was here. So I think the one concern that we would have is just the timeline for the department to come back with a report or any of the planning work. So as you know, they have been stopped from any of those efforts or even those conversations with the Department of Homeland Security. And so even if this was passed on March 8th, I think, if my math is right, I think that they would have 22 calendar days to get a report back. And so I would just put out that this is a priority and we will do everything we can, but because they will have to have conversations with the Department of Homeland Security and do a lot of that work, we will do everything to meet that deadline, but perhaps if there was some communication in between, maybe they can answer some of the easier questions throughout the process, things like that. But I would just have some trepidation about waiting that entire period, and then there would still be some questions that the committee would have. So, but we look forward to working to get this done. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here, being part of our group. Next on my list is Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My concerns, I think Senator Limmer expressed them and others here, and I apologize for not making all these meetings. If there's been any consideration for the federal program of pre-check, that those people will be maybe not have to pay to have a federal real ID. They've already put $85 in for those people that have, and again, it's a federal program with a background check. Federal pre-check is a program that that allows you to get a background check ahead of time so that you don't have to go through the security the same way and with the long lines. So,
you know,
just for consideration.
I don't know if council has any knowledge of whether that would work or not. Mr. Burris, you know?
Madam Chair, I hadn't looked at the possible relationship between the two, so I'm
well, if that could be done, Madam Chair, that's all I'm asking.
All right, great. Thank you, Senator Hall. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I just want to ask you a question, but before I do that, I want to set it up by saying that, you know, this is really in responding to what Representative Whelan and Senator Limmer has put on the table, because it is on the table. And I have to say, members, I don't think this is that complicated. What we have is a responsibility to meet Minnesota needs and a responsibility to respond to needs of the federal government. I think we can do both. I think we can do both now. And, you know, Representative Scott, and I ask this respectfully, because you put something on the table, and I know when I put things on the table, you know, folks are going to come after me, what's here, what's not here, what's missing, but that's part of our process. So you're chair of the Data Privacy Committee here. We've got a data privacy issue square that's always been at the center of this issue. In addition to that, I would say that there is an authority issue around the state, so there's two things on the table here. If we're going to work off of your bill for this session, and I think it's a good starting place to work off of, so I'm okay with that, are you amenable to accepting language that would add a noncompliant option for us so that we can respond to the issues that we're hearing from both sides of the aisle here? It seems to me that's a logical thing to do, and because time is short, I mean, otherwise I'd be having this conversation with you quietly, but, you know, we're moving in a very short session, so I really feel compelled to ask you whether that's within your, you know, comfort and okayness and desire in responding to what you're hearing here today.
I'll thank you for the question. You know, I've heard a lot of really good feedback today, and I guess I would say that I want to continue to get feedback from the remainder of our body here in the legislature. I don't have a great level of comfort anytime I have to turn over my personal information, and I know most Minnesotans don't, although some of them don't seem to care at this point. They just want to be able to get into these facilities and get on airplanes. And part of that probably is, you know, we need to be letting people know more about what's at stake by doing that. I guess I would say that I will not make a final decision where I come down until I hear a full vetting from the rest of the body.
Well, fair enough. Madam Chair, thank you. And I know I put you in a comfortable position here because you came in with your own bill. But Carlos isn't pulling this out of, you know, midair. I mean, this is a conversation that's circling around this table. It's been circling around the state for many years. It is at the core of our actions back several years ago, and will be, no matter what we do here, will be at the center of our ongoing relationship with the federal government on this issue and with the constantly evolving nature of data and data privacy and issues of state authority in the state. You know, Senator Scott, you know, because only because, you know, I should do this in a bipartisan manner, where are you relative to this issue? As a, you know, culture of the working group, where's the room in the Senate relative to this issue of a noncompliance?
Thank you. I like being called Senator Scott.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes,
sir. My neighbors used to call me Mr. Scott.
Scott. Yeah. I looked over and said, Peggy Scott, Scott Dibble. Got
yeah.
it.
We're a great team.
I apologize.
So I very strongly support a second-tier non-compliant driver's license myself. I don't have a sense of the larger body either. You know, how many of our members think that's important to include, that we do real ID compliant and also then give folks in Minnesota an option for kind of a second-tier non-compliant like they've done in other states. I personally very strongly support that idea and would like to see that happen at either in Bill 1, if that has to happen in Bill 1, if we decide we're going to go whole hog on Bill 1. But I suspect we can't go whole hog on Bill 1, that we need Bill 1 to kind of get our ducks in a row, and then in Bill 2 we would include that provision. but, you know, again, begs all these questions. Are we going to be able to get a bill to through the pipeline in time this legislative session? And is that important? Some think it is, some think it is, some think it isn't. I think it is, and I think it's, I don't think it's that I think we can do this. You know, some think there's a rush and some think there's not a rush. I think we are still under some time pressure to just get this resolved.
I'd like to move to some public comment now. Is there anyone from the public that wishes to testify? Please come forward. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead and take a seat there, but I forgot Representative Fabian does have a question. You can go ahead and come to the table and be ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to all the members that are here today, thanks for bringing issues forward. I have a question that's a little bit different than what we have been discussing. On page 2, line 2.5, this would be for Mr. Burris probably. When you live where I live, obviously there's access issues to, you know, what we're talking about doing. I had the opportunity, I don't know, 2 months ago to get my enhanced driver's license. And I'll say contrary to what Representative Urusso said about, I don't remember, she said it was a lot of paperwork. It really wasn't for me. The big issue for me was I had to go to Central Minnesota, Bemidji, to get an enhanced driver's license. 130 miles one way. So my question here is twofold. The itemized costs that we're asking here for, is that also going to reflect on the costs that would be incurred by our local deputy registrars in order to then be able to issue real ID compliant driver's licenses rather than having to drive 200-300 miles?
Mr. Burris.
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, obviously the language doesn't address what all costs should be handled or considered in the report, and there are a couple of ways that could be further clarified. One would be modification of the bill draft. Another would be in conversations with the department about what the legislative expectation is in that construing costs broadly, if you will, to include deputy registrar local costs as well as costs of the department. In general, I would think I would tend to expect the department to look at their costs as opposed to, you know, a citizen additional out-of-pocket costs or fiscal impacts to citizens, and they might or might not take into account deputy registrars absent further directive or discussions with the, you know, with the department.
Representative Fabian, I know Mr. Hurst is sitting here, yeah. And I spoke with him prior to the meeting, and they do have a couple of comments on that specific thing. And Ms. Braze, if you don't mind, since we're on this topic, if he could come forward and just go on the record with his concerns about that.
Yeah,
you can stay at the table. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, I'm Jim Hurst on behalf of the Minnesota Deputy Registrars Association. Thank you, Representative Fabian, for bringing up that point. And yes, I was very concerned in reviewing this bill that directing the department to put forward a report back to the legislature itemizing identified costs without further direction or anything. I believe the department would probably just take that to mean, okay, what are the costs that we, the department, will incur. For some of you that aren't familiar with deputy registrars, we are appointed or we are deputized and appointed to be agents of the state, but that means we incur all of the costs at the local offices to provide services. Our only compensation is in the little filing fee that we are able to keep. So my concern here is that moving forward towards some type of eventual implementation, there are going to be background checks that must be done on all of the individuals that work at a deputy office. That will incur a cost, most likely borne by the office. There are training requirements as far as making sure everyone is trained properly to know what to look for, what to accept as far as legitimate documents are concerned. There's also equipment questions. Do we need to invest in more equipment, such as scanners, to electronically transfer information to the state, as well as storage questions? If we can have the flexibility to keep some of this information in an electronic storage medium, a secure electronic storage medium. Otherwise, the alternative would be to seek out secure storage facilities to keep documents, backup documents. By law, we have to maintain like a five-year retention schedule on certain documents, especially driver's license applications and supporting documents. And over the course of 5 years, certainly the volume is immense, and we don't have room in our offices to keep them stored on site. So those are just some of the concerns that we have moving forward, but certainly if the department is going to be charged with doing a report identifying costs, I think it would be prudent that they also recognize what some of those costs are that we would be expected to bear. And one last thing, and this is just a clarification. Representative Fabian, just earlier you mentioned about you used the term going to a deputy registrar office to have them issue a driver's license, or I want to be clear, we only accept the applications. The state is a central they're set up where the state actually issues the driver's license. I know there are some states that don't do that, but in this state, it's the state that issues it. We merely take in the applications and forward them on to the state, and they make the final determination. So that is what I wanted to talk about today in regards to this aspect of the bill, and I'd be glad to take any questions if anyone chooses.
Thank you. Representative Fabian, do you have follow-up? Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I did have that in my notes to make sure that I clarified that. One of the things that when I applied for mine, and it is an application process, after I was finished that day, I'd say it was about 5 weeks when I got my enhanced driver's license in the mail from DPS. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there is a lag there. I don't remember what the lag is on a regular driver's license, how long that takes. But when I did do that day, you know, I did the paperwork, and then I had the application, a copy of the application that they told me was my driver's license now, and then my existing driver's license, they put in a little thing and stamped it, and that one then became void. But I still could use it as, not a driver's license, but I could still use it for a picture ID or something like that. So they informed me I should keep that until I received my new enhanced driver's license.
Yeah.
And of course, and I've said this before, for me living where I do, in Roseau County, the main reason that I want an enhanced driver's license is so I don't have to be looking for my passport when I go to Ontario, which is just, you know, not that far away, to go fishing or snowmobiling or whatever, Manitoba. And people that live in Kitson County and Roseau County and Lake of the Woods County and Kuching County frequently cross the border for recreation or shopping or seeing friends or whatever. So the convenience factor there was my main sure. motivation for getting that. And it is Real ID compliant too, by the way. So mm-hmm. when I get on an airplane, I'm
good
in the future.
Yeah.
And they were not. And the other thing is it's a 4-year delay. My license wasn't going to be expiring until this June. Now, the enhanced driver's license that I have expires in June of 2020, so it's actually over 4 years, so they extended that time on mine. So,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hurst. Representative Mariani, do you have a question for this testifier?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very quickly, so you were here earlier. You heard some of the discussion around the possibility of a real of a non-compliant Real ID license. Are there any issues relative to your sector in terms of processing an alternative license in addition to if we do the real ID.
Mr. Hurst.
Certainly. Thank you, Chairperson Scott and Representative Mariani. We certainly are well equipped to do the regular driver's license and state-issued IDs, of course. In our opinion, we're also very well positioned to take applications for the enhanced driver's license. However, the State Department of Public Safety chose to only keep that as an option for citizens who only visit the 13 state facilities. And I can't speak on behalf of the department as to what their rationale was on that, but we certainly were expecting to be able to take applications for EDL when the legislation was first passed, but we were informed
thank
otherwise.
You. Senator Limmer, one last question to this testifier, then we'll bring Ms. Bays
up. Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is really directed to Representative Fabian.
Okay.
You sought an enhanced Minnesota driver license, and you said in your question that you had to travel to a distant location in order to process that. So while we're talking of costs, we're talking of costs in this bill regarding what government will pay, what's the cost of government, but what were some of the costs that you had to go through to get an enhanced driver license, not to mention a real ID compliant official fancy U.S. government approved driver license? You had travel costs. I think you had to get a birth certificate, perhaps. You didn't. I know that in real ID you do have to show proof that you're an American citizen or your status of citizenship, so most people that'll be a birth certificate. That means that I will have to go to South Dakota to get mine or see if they could issue it somehow. And then it has to be approved with an official stamp to make sure that it satisfies the requirement of the federal government. And if you weren't born here, then you'd have to show proof that you went through your citizenship class. And if that was 20, 30, 40 years ago, then you're going to have to go find that diploma or whatever they issue, some certificate of sorts, that you are, in fact, the U.S. citizen. I might suggest that perhaps somebody should analyze what the cost is going to be on the individual citizen of how much that's going to cost them to dig up all their old records. And, of course, in our discussion of picture ID for voting purposes a few years ago, there are a number of very old people that were born that were never issued birth certificates. Which raises a whole different question of conflicting laws in how we do things in Minnesota versus what the federal government is asking. I haven't even raised those questions yet. So.
I will tell you that I recently requested a certified copy of my birth certificate from where I was born in Iowa, and it cost me $20, and I had it. As soon as they got my check in the mail, they issued it. I had it within a number of days. But Representative Fabian, if you want to go through what you, the hoops you jumped through to get your enhanced, that'd be great.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Limmer, quite honestly, the only costs that I incurred were my travel costs, you know, to Bemidji and back. The documentation that I needed, I did not bring my birth certificate with me, but I do have a passport. And if you look at the requirements for the enhanced driver's license on the DPS website, there's a number of different things that you have to prove, but a number of different items, you know, fit into those different columns. So for me, there was no additional cost. It was just the travel time. And if you know, there again, it's kind of a nice drive from Rosa to Bemidji. You get to do a little sightseeing and see a few bald eagles laying on a dead deer in the ditch and, you know, you know, stuff like that. So, and then
Madam Chair, I wish I could say the same thing when I drive to South Dakota.
Yeah. Well, and
but and to kind of reemphasize Chair Scott's thing, most of this can be done, you know, on the phone and so forth. And I understand the concerns that people have, but about a lot of these issues, and I'm concerned about them too. But for me, it was it would have been no additional cost for me whatsoever if I could have gone to my local deputy registrar, Jody Ziska, who does a great job up there in Rosehill. So, thank you.
And I would say that if he would not have had a passport, which to get a passport, you have to show a certified copy of your birth certificate.
Right.
So had he not had that, he would have had to provide that. And, but he's already paid for that once.
Madam Chair, I just want to point out, if it costs you $20 to get your birth certificate from Iowa, multiply that by 5 million of our residents. Mm-hmm. And that'll be another $10 million cost to the people of Minnesota.
Right. Well, not all 5 million are driving yet, but eventually.
Well, many will need an ID card.
Right, right. Okay. Ms. Brace, please come to the table. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and introduce yourself to the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and we are known for our efforts in privacy. And part of the reason that we are so focused on privacy is we look at privacy as the foundation for freedom. And we say, he who holds the data makes the rules. So when it comes to the Real ID, what we know is that the public has heard, you can't fly. But what we also know is that they haven't been told what Real ID really is or what it will lead to. So the Real ID is a national identification card that has been opposed by a large coalition of left and right-leaning organizations called the Privacy Coalition. There are 100 federal requirements that a complying state must conform to, including the creation of a state database of all required citizen identification information, including biometrics, that is accessible to the federal government and every other state government. This is essentially a national network database with the identification documents of all Americans. This national network data system also provides an opportunity for hackers in and outside of the country. Now, some of you may know that the Office of Personnel Management had 22 million of their federal employees, retired and current, their information hacked, including 5 million fingerprints. So the fact that the state issues Real ID and bears the extraordinary cost of implementing it does not make it a state ID. It's really a national ID funded by the state. The total estimate for state compliance is $11 billion nationwide. This is 100 times more than when Congress passed the bill and said it would cost only $100 million. Notably, Homeland Security says, when you're thinking about the cost of this and the fact that Minnesota already has an enhanced driver's license, Homeland Security says that the enhanced driver's license works for these purposes, and it says five states have them, including Minnesota. So there's actually no reason for Minnesota to do Real ID. Even the department says that. So as you've already noted, the Secretary of Homeland Security also has the authority to change the purpose of the card anytime. Secretary Chertoff in 2008 said, embracing Real ID would mean that it would be used to, quote, cash a check, hire a babysitter, board a plane, or engage in countless other activities, end quote. The secretary is empowered by the law to determine its use, not the states. So once it's out of your hands and you've decided to do it, they're in control. So there are at least four problems with the proposed bill. First, it would allow full planning for an implementation of Real ID. So to pass it just means that you let the government do as they wish and use it for what they want. Two, it disempowers the state legislature, the elected representatives of the people. There is no protection for Minnesotans in this bill. It only requires legislative leadership to review any new uses that the unelected officials in the federal government would require. This language is essentially powerless, and that, I think, has already been noted today. The federal regulators and not even Congress will be in control. Number three, the public for whom this bill is ostensibly written will have all of their rights of protection under Chapter 13 rulemaking stripped away. The bill gives authority to unelected state regulators to write rules that become law, and neither you or your constituents will be able to stop or alter the laws they make until next session, but only if you're in power and can muster the collective will to stop them. Unless, of course, as the woman whose name I cannot pronounce either, unless you add the 100 letters, because expedited rulemaking means there's no opportunity for a public hearing about anything that is going to be put into law by the unelected officials. And the fourth one is there is no allowance for or requirement of a dual track. And so I'm glad to hear that some people are interested around this table to have a dual track. For those who don't want to have a federal ID or participate in what could quickly become a federal tracking system of all the activities related to the use of the ID, which could expand and expand and expand. Now, as a healthcare policy organization, we're particularly opposed to Real ID because we see it as a backdoor to a national patient ID. Now, the national patient ID, which is actually in law, in HIPAA, it's required, a unique patient identifier, has been prohibited for 17 years at the federal level due to a funding prohibition, and that has never been taken away. So we do not have a national patient ID today, even though it's in law in HIPAA. So this we look at as a backdoor into that. And when you go to clinics today, you probably have them asking you for your identification. They're asking for your identification because of the red flags law, or red flags rule, which is a federal rule, which a federal law already says that they don't have to do. But a lot of the clinics haven't figured that out yet. So they don't have to do it, but they're doing it. And they would do the very same thing with the Real ID. And therefore, every patient encounter would be tracked through the Real ID. And we consider this opposite to freedom in America, all of this tracking. And so finally, not having a Real ID does not mean you cannot fly. According to the Chicago Tribune, Illinois, which estimates that the cost to implement Real ID would be $50 to $60 million, they're like us, they're not doing it, but they were told that if the state did not comply, their citizens would still be able to fly but would be subject to more security checks. So it's clear that the federal government cannot penalize the state for doing this. That's why we're so far down the line from when it was passed in 2005, and states have said no, and the federal government can do these threats. But it's unconstitutional commandeering of the state to actually require you to implement a federal law. The federal government is required to implement federal laws, not states. So I just want you to realize that the Real ID is an unconstitutional overreach of the federal government and a violation of our 10th Amendment state and individual rights. And if you implement it, you have taken your hands off the ability to even protect the constituents in this state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any questions for the testifier? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Brace, I think I heard you correctly. So let me just sum it up. It's your analysis that the language that we currently have before us puts us at risk of data privacy concerns, and that it begs I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I'm trying to be concise, and that it puts as a logical step, if we're going to do this, to create some kind of a parallel non-compliant Real ID compliant license. Does that sum up accurately your position?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, my position, I would say, is yes, there are significant patient privacy concerns, and it's very interesting. NPR did an article in January where there is a Carol Shawbach from Andover, who said that she had to provide all of these documentation, and much like Representative Fabian said, it's all the same documentation for Real ID that is for the enhanced driver's license. And when she thought about it, she thought of all of her identification documents in that one place, and she said that she was concerned about outside access or somebody who had bad things in mind for her data. But now the public doesn't understand that with Real ID, it's a national networked database of all of this.
So Madam Chair, I really think we should be moving forward, and I don't think it's really controversial with a parallel system here. I think we can do that now. You've got the bill before us. If we're not going to do that in this bill, are there other avenues that you're going to explore as chair of the data privacy to protect those data privacy concerns relative to what Real ID puts out on the table?
Well, I think that there's not complete consensus to put a dual track in a bill that we take up on the first couple of days of session. I don't think that has been vetted with the rest of the body, so I can't say that would be the right action to take at this point in the initial bill.
And so, Madam Chair, perhaps, but I do think that, you know, we have a data privacy committee. seems to me that this issue ought to be in that committee. Mm-hmm. You're the chair of that committee. I would think, hearing what we're hearing, that there ought to be some action if we're going to move forward with this language or any other language this session to protect those data privacy issues.
We'll be taking this up in my committee. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Braze, I appreciate your testimony, and I share your angst about federal overreach. We've seen much of that. And also about the concern about breaches and hacks. We've seen all that across not just Minnesota but the nation. I have one comment and then one question. In regards to do we need a real ID compliant driver's license when we have the enhanced driver's license? And in January, I had a call with the Department of Homeland Security after one of our meetings when we couldn't get answers here because of the ban on planning, and we couldn't have people here to answer. So I spoke with the Department of Homeland Security Deputy Undersecretary about this, and one of the things that I learned then was that, yes, there is a reason to have an option for the Real ID compliant driver's license, and that is because that driver's license does not have a RFID tag in it, whereas the enhanced driver's license does. So in my mind, I see that as one more option that we need to have available to Minnesotans. So I appreciate the dual-track approach. It could be really a tri-track with the non-compliant, the compliant ID, and the enhanced driver's license, so that Minnesotans can choose which of those avenues best fits their needs. So that was my comment. But then my question has to do with national ID, which is a concerning idea as well. And I want to know, in my conversation with the Department of Homeland Security, they were very clear that the states actually hold the keys to the vault as far as what happens to the data and who has access to it. And can other states have access? Can the federal government have access? And so I'd like to know from Ms. Braze and from staff, perhaps, you know, what makes you think that the feds actually and other states would have access to our state database, and then maybe the staff can fill in a little bit more on that as well.
Ms. Braze.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I cannot remember, but I believe it's in the, it might even be in the law itself, where it says that the data has to be accessible to all other 50 states as well as the federal government. So that is a requirement, which is why I say that it's a nationally networked database. And of course, I can't imagine, and maybe the deputy registrar here could actually even say this, I can't imagine that they would have one separate data system for that for their own data. So let's say Minnesota, right, have a separate data system that all Minnesota's data is in. And then when they want to go find out data on someone in New Mexico or Florida or Washington, now they're going to switch to a different system to connect with everybody else's data system. My guess is it will all be incorporated together into a way they're not going to switch data systems. It will be one data system that they will use to connect to all the other databases.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Ms. Braze. That is not actually what I heard from the Department of Homeland Security. So now I want to turn to our Minnesota Council here, and I'd like to know if, in fact, those who have might have the federal legislation in front of them, if that accessibility by all 50 states and the feds is actually part of the Real ID Act, and if it is, what kind of precautions can we put in place in Minnesota law to safeguard our data so that it is just available and accessible to Minnesotans, not to feds and other states? How do we keep the keys to that vault, so to speak?
Sure. Ms. Berezovsky.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, my understanding, and I'm having trouble coming up with it, but that is that, yes, the data is available to all 50 states and the federal government. And I spoke a little bit to our counsel who works on data issues in Senate Counsel Office, and she had a little bit of an exchange with Stacy Christensen. I'm not familiar with exactly who that is, but anyway, they discussed it a little bit, and they did I believe that Ms. Pontius in our office was informed that the Driver Privacy Protection Act, I think is what DPPA stands for, which is a federal law, would govern the treatment of data in the 50 states. And beyond that, as to what the state can do, I am not prepared to answer that question, but I think Ms. Pontius has done some work along those lines.
Thank you. Madam Chair, just a final comment. I think that's important that we know what our options are then to safeguard that data and how we can control the keys to really that vault of data. And that's unclear to me at this point from my conversations here and conversations with DHS. But I'd like to delve into that further.
Sure. I know Ms. Christensen is here. I don't know if she has any answers to that in the conversations. She's with the Department of Admin and... Thanks for sitting in the audience today and being at our beck and call. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Absolutely. Hello, Stacey Christensen with the Department of Administration, specifically the Information Policy Analysis Division. And I'm not sure I have any specific answers to the question, but the general idea as to what Senate Counsel mentioned was the data are protected under the Federal Data Privacy Protection Act, and there are a number of permissible uses for that data. So that could be how access is granted between the states and by the federal government if it fits under one of those permissible uses. And Minnesota has basically codified that federal law in our state statute. So it would be kind of an analysis as to whether it fits under the permissible use under federal law as how that data are accessed among the states.
Grace. So I would just like to read for the committee what the statute actually says. And this is under, I think it's other requirements, D, other requirements. And 12, D12 says, provide electronic access to all other states to information contained in the motor vehicle database of the state.
Thank you, Ms. Grace. Senator Limmer, final question, and we have to get out of this room. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for a person from Department of Administration. The way you understand the Real ID bill in Congress giving the authority to Homeland Security Director to expand it whenever they want, does that create a conflict of law with existing federal statutes if they change the law and expand it for a different function, a function that only that individual director can make? Are we creating, do you understand that as perhaps a potential conflict of law with something already existing?
Ms. Christensen.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I'm an expert on data practices and certainly not conflict of law, but I think it would probably depend on the purpose that they, you know, if there would be a conflict with the Data Practices Act, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I would have to analyze it under that specific new purpose, but I can't say just generally whether there would be some sort of federal conflict there.
And one last question. When we write agreements with the federal government when we would be the holder of information, that doesn't mean that the federal government doesn't have that information. It means that they would write an agreement to share that information. And we already know that it's in the federal law that we're going to share this information with any other state that wants it, which raises other questions about conflict of existing state statute law. Again, Minnesota is a very strong privacy state. We protect information that other states do not. And so I always get concerned when we push data off beyond our borders, because once that happens, then we lose our enforceability on that protection that we've offered our people. But when we send it off, or a researcher for medical data goes off, they might violate a contract, but they're actually violating our state law, but we can do nothing about it. We can't enforce it. Is that a concern for the Department of Administration?
Ms. Christensen.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I'm not prepared to speak to that specific concern as of right now, but certainly How the law works right now is when there is some sort of non-legal authority to share data and there's some sort of contractual obligation between the two parties to the contract, that there is a requirement to include Minnesota's legal protections in that requirement. So, you know, that would be something that would stay in place.
There's always that provision, but the enforceability is gone.
Yeah. Well, and I know even talking to some folks in the law enforcement community, they said they can already call if they see an out-of-state plate. They can already call and access who owns that vehicle, their address. All that information is already in the data in a database shared amongst the states. So, yes.
I'd like to
Senator Carr.
Ask one question. Just if sometime we can get a refreshment of where this data will be shared. Senator Limmer and I and former Senator Mimua had a bill back in 2008 that was the same bill that was passed in 2009 unanimously. And some of the concerns we had then was that the description was that the Real ID database, and it's many databases, I would assume, was going to be accessible to Interpol, to there's an Interpol-like police investigative agency in South America. And we already know that Canada gets our driver's license information and gets our Real ID information. And I guess I would assume that because enhanced driver's license are also going to be useful to go into Mexico, that there's other databases that are shared with other countries. And I guess I would like to be refreshed on just how far this goes and where outside of the United States this data will be shared. You all see CSI, and CSI, they can look up anything, your library books and your relatives and everything in moments. And I'm not so sure that this isn't where we're headed with this. And it's international also.
Representative Mariani.
Chair, on that point, I'll try to be really brief. I'm not an expert either, but it's pretty clear to me that the federal government set up a different animal when they created this framework in Real ID. There's a ton of questions that we just simply don't know. It's going to take us some time in terms of what kind of data, who's going to get it, where's it going to go, and what's our redress relative to that. Again, it seems to me we have a simple way to deal with that issue at this point by moving forward with something that allows Minnesotans to opt into a valid instrument that ensures public safety but does not step us into that until such time as we have that deeper conversations with them. I'm not trying to tell you your business. You're the chair of the Data Privacy Committee. This is exactly what that committee should be doing. My fear, Madam Chair, is that we've got the beginning here, and it's good. We have the beginning of something where there's an urgency for us to move. But if we don't move without this other component, it seems to me that we're really running a pretty high risk relative to our principles, relative to our data concerns, relative to our constituencies. And if we don't do it now, we lose all the leverage that we're ever going to have with the federal government to do it down the line. So, again, I'm just really going to press you, as the chair of the Data Privacy Committee, as the author of this possible bill, to really seriously incorporate that element in here. I've not heard anyone come forward and say they have a really big issue with us creating that third option here. I haven't heard anyone say that. You and I sat together at that hearing with DHS, and you and I had a good time beating the heck out of them at that meeting, and you shared some very real concerns, just personally about, some of these data issues. We can address those issues in a real simple way here today. Love to work with you.
Thank you. Folks, we do need to wrap this up. I want to thank my co-chair of this working group, Senator Dibble, and we will absolutely take into account what was talked about here today and look forward to moving something hopefully the first week of session so we can at least get the ball rolling. So with that, the meeting's adjourned.